Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Legendarium Green Team, where we cover the books we love that the main team can't keep up with. I'm your host, Chesky, and today I'm joined by Little Red Book.
Hello, nobody can keep up with you, Chesky.
And our illustrious guest author, Sebastian de Castell.
Hi, everybody.
We're going to be discussing the book Dragon Song by Anne McCaffrey. And Sebastian, you are the one who recommended us to read this book with you. So why this book? What is it about this book that makes it so exciting for you?
Well, so Dragon Song, so readers of Anne McCaffrey, or even people who don't read Anne McCaffrey, probably know her as the creator of the Dragon Riders of Pern books, which mm-hmm. were, you know, came out, I think, in the 60s, the first ones, and were really kind of the big dragon books for the longest time. You know, now we've had tons and tons of other sort of dragon books, but the whole notion, the particular reader appeal of, you know, being kind of bonded to a dragon was popularized, not necessarily invented by, but popularized very much by Anne McCaffrey. And so the Dragon Riders of Pern books were adult fantasy books that really delved into that. They are technically, they feel like fantasy for a lot of people, but they're technically science fiction. Anne McCaffrey is very careful to remind you with the prologues of every single book that this is taking place on the planet, you know, Rubicat, and they're in this system, and it's, you know, these are you know, genetically engineered creatures. But when you read them, it feels like a medieval fantasy. But Dragon Song was the first time where she wrote what at the time would have been called a children's novel inside that world, but we would probably think of as a young adult novel now. Mm-hmm. But of course, one of the beauties of those kind of classic novels from that era is that they tended to be neither, you know, now young adult and all sort of young adult categories have become very sort of regimented. You know, we can really define every single part of it. So we know the difference between a middle grade book versus a young adult book, for example, right? Middle grade is mostly for 8 to 12 year olds, you know, that's where the protagonist is going to be 12 to 16. And, you know, young adult is going to be for 13 to 18 year olds, where the protagonist is sort of 17, 18, 19. Although, in fact, most young adult appears to be consumed by 35-year-olds.
guilty, yes, guilty. You got me.
Which is, you know, having written a fairly popular young adult series, I've been sometimes pleasingly, sometimes bafflingly exposed to the very different ways in which the book you write, you know, when you write, the part of you tries to write in terms of an audience, you're trying to speak to people. And I find with YA, like, you never want to preach with YA, but you do, there is a kind of a running thing that you're trying to say often when you're writing YA, which is, it's okay, what's happening to you is not totally your fault, and other people have gone through it. Mm-hmm. Right? Sometimes it feels this way, you're not crazy.
And also just, it's so awkward. Like that whole age range. I remember somebody saying something about feeling uncomfortable during puberty, and I'm like, yeah, that's everybody. We all feel that way. It's just an annoying age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I used to tell the story that the part of how Spellslinger came about for me, like that whole series, and that character in particular was because Spellslinger is, I used to call it the anti Harry Potter, and I love the Harry Potter books. I think they're brilliant, but I really could not relate to being the kid who thinks that he's very average and unimportant, but discovers he's actually this unbelievably powerful wizard with this unbelievably grand destiny, whose parents actually loved him far more than all other parents, and by the way, is also rich. Like that was not my experience of my teenage years. And I used to tell people, like, my experience in my teenage years was standing in the hall in front of my locker when the first bell was ringing and watching all my fellow students coming in the doorways and having this thought of, like, wow, you know, I'm not the smartest person in this school. Like, I'm not the most athletic person in this school. I am not the most talented person in this school. I'm definitely not the best looking person in school. I don't even have the best personality in this school. Like, I am not special in any way, shape, or form. And so Spellslinger is, you know, a story of a series about a young man who lives in a very magical society, whose parents are very powerful mages, whose younger sister is the most precocious, talented mage of her generation, and who's discovering that his own magical abilities are fading down to nothing. So that's one of the things that YA is great for. It's a way of saying, and possibly lots of literary forms do this, but I think YA tends to do it particularly well, of saying the way that you're feeling, it's okay to feel this way. And let's explore, let's live in the world of that feeling a little bit and look for ways out of it. And Dragon Song by Anne McCaffrey, which is, again, set in the world of Pern with these dragons and stuff like that, is about a young woman who lives in who wants to be what's called a harper, which is kind of like the equivalent on Pern of a bard, of a minstrel. And but because she lives in a quite a sort of old-fashioned part of the world, girls are not supposed to become harpers. Mm-hmm. And so she goes through all these tribulations about that of having to not being allowed to perform, not being allowed to sing, not being allowed to write songs, and it opens in a beautiful way with the old harper, because it takes place in what's called a sea hold. So it's like a sort of a manor, but on the sea, where they, you know, they do lots of fishing and stuff like that. And her father's the Lord Holder, and the hold always has a harper who helps teach the children and, you know, keep the culture alive and share stories and news. And the old harper has died. And so because they have nobody else who can do the job, they need to allow her for a little while, but they hate it so much. You know, her parents are so horrified.
Yeah.
It sets off all these events, but so I won't describe the whole book, but it's a wonderful story about feeling like you're not allowed to do something that you want to do, and feeling like you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is almost the most single descriptive way of viewing one's adolescence. That for me, as a young man, who nobody ever, you know, in my experience, when I was a young man, nobody ever said, oh, you can't do this, or you're not going to write for this, or you shouldn't try to do, like, no one ever did that to me. And so the fact that Anne McCaffrey could write a book in which I could completely empathize with a female character who's being denied the chance to be what she wants to be specifically because she's female, and that I could read that and go, I totally feel it. I'm mentally, you know,
yeah,
just shows how great the book is.
No, it really was great like that. Like you said, you could really feel her desire to want to play, and then just the shame that's put on her. Oh, I can't believe you still like to play. Like, you have to just do this, but like nobody mentions it. And the way her father kind of manipulates everybody else in the whole hell to be like, after this, you just don't ever mention it. I can't believe she hasn't gotten over it yet. Like, it took me a little bit to get into the book. This is kind of like my first real entry into Pern. And so I was just trying to get used to it. And I read a little bit of the prologue part before it, where it tells me like the whole backstory of what's happened. And I was like, this is really confusing and I'm not sure I understand, but I think I'll be okay. And I start reading the book, and then I started reading it. It was just about Melanie. And I guess I was looking at the back to what happened in the past and thinking it's going to be more epic fantasy. And this is more like bard level fantasy. Like, she wants to be the bard, she wants to be the harper. And so I wasn't sure what was going to happen, but I really ended up liking it a lot. And it was quite fun. And just like this nice, almost cozy adventure, where it's like, it's not too exciting or too out there, but it's like this perfect small story that just encapsulates her growing up a little bit. And like, you can really feel her feelings though, when she's scared of going back to her old home, and she's like, don't tell anybody I'm here, just leave me, you know, I'll do whatever you guys want. And I just, like, I was touched by it. I thought it was really well done. So,
so yes, it's nice that there's not, so many of our fantasy stories have world ending stakes. So it's nice to read a story that isn't that. But I wonder if this is more about, one, she takes things, I do think she does take things too personally sometimes. Like, she, when she gets cut, her hand gets cut, and she's like, I didn't do it on purpose. And her mom's like, nobody thought you cut your hand on purpose. I feel like the mom is in an abusive relationship. I feel like the whole holding is in an abusive relationship with this dude who's her dad. And, you know, he wouldn't have been happy if one of his boys had been taken away to do something besides fishing. Like, he was just like, the men fish, the women cook, and that is like his whole world.
Yeah.
And
well, I think when she cut her knife, that's kind of indicative of like the teenage experience, though.
Yeah, everyone's
you
looking know, at me.
You hurt yourself or you hurt yourself or something, and you think, oh, he's gone. But then you're like, oh no, that was like, you know, you think everybody's looking at you, even if maybe they're not.
Yes.
And you're like, you're worried, like, oh, I see. No, I'm the center of attention, which is what I want, but it's also immensely scary to me all of a sudden. And I definitely don't want, you know, people to get the wrong opinion. Yeah,
there's just a lot of, there was a lot of, in the first part of the book, where I was just like, have we gone into spoilers already?
Not really, but kind of.
I just feel like in the first part of the book, there was a lot of missing communication. And a lot of her just thinking that everybody is looking at her when, like, most people aren't even thinking about her. And anyway, so that was kind of my thought on her as a character. And I like that the adults later in the book help her move past that in a healthy way.
Yeah, I'm excited to read on and see what happens after this. It was a good start to a little trilogy, so I'm going to keep going on.
Yeah, the second book is fun, too. I hear what you're saying, Red, about her mentally sort of being, in a lot of ways, too overly sensitive. I don't find that to be inauthentic.
No, I don't
though,
either.
Certainly to my own experience. Teenager, yeah, it's but and that's one of the things that you know that I was sort of alluding to earlier is that you know some stories everyone can appreciate every kind of story, right? Like we can all sit down and find a stack of whatever Archie comics and maybe we can enjoy them,
maybe.
But we have to recognize that. But we have to recognize that they're not being directed at our own sensibilities, right? I would be the same. I'm a lot more troubled when I read a book that is ostensibly for an adult readership where the main characters have that level of hypersensitivity. Everything's about me. Everybody hates me. And I find I read an awful lot of that lately. You would think that when people go off to magical college, you know, that they suddenly lose like 10 years of emotional maturity somehow based on a lot of books that I'm reading. But I think with mentally, like you do, as Chesky was sort of alluding to, you do get some of that sense of just the trauma, the trauma of like what, you know, who she has become through that. Mm-hmm. And, as a person at the beginning of the book, who is just constantly aware of the fact of her father's disapproval. Mm-hmm. And so interprets almost everything through it. And there are moments where some of the moments that I find so poignant, almost troubling. Is it okay to put spoilers in or?
Yeah, I think that's fine. We'll just say that we're spoiling the book. If you haven't read it, it's 40 years old. Get to it.
Yeah, it's more than 40 years old. But I won't sort of spoil any of the sort of the ending or anything like that. But there's a part where I think, as Red alluded, mentioned, where Menly's hand gets cut and her mother, who's sort of the hold's healer, stitches up the wound and doesn't stitch it up exactly right. Not to hurt her daughter, but to solve the problem. To go, she'll still be able to have a happy life, but she won't be able to play guitar so well. And when you think of, and that for me as an emotional beat is it's so troubling, but I can totally see it happening. And it's exploring those places that I think young adult fiction can sometimes do so well. That sense of unfairness.
The interesting thing about that part of the story for me was that she's delirious, right? Because she has this horrible fever.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother sits there by her side the entire time. And you also have this similar thing going on with her brother, who, when they hear the pipes blowing and the new Harper puts together oh, it's your sister that's missing and it's your sister that wrote those songs. And her brother's like, she's just better off. She's just better off not being here because she's not appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
almost everybody in the town felt that way about her. Just like, she's better off not here.
Which says something about, that's why I said it. So it feels like the entire holding is in an abusive relationship with her dad because they're all like, oh, good, she got away.
No, but that's the small, that's something that you see in small towns mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. Small towns are communities that work based on a specific set of ingredients. And when you introduce an ingredient that doesn't fit, that suddenly conflicts with other people, it's the most natural thing in the world to think, yeah, you know, if that trans couple next door just moved away, wouldn't everything just go back to being so simple, you know? And that's the kind of thing that people often feel, because it's very challenging to try to reconfigure, you know, what you're used to, and to have to go through all the different conflicts. If you think about, like, if you sort of reimagine the story and you go, okay, let's say Mentally doesn't leave and we don't have the little fire lizards, which are like mini dragons, which we haven't talked about, which is one of the super fun parts of the book.
Super fun parts.
But let's say you don't have any of that, and it's actually just a very sort of literary story. Excuse me, I have the world's worst cold. But you sort of, you know what's going to happen? It would be like a long series of conflicts. It would be conflicts and people taking sides, and possibly Yanis, the Lord Holder, Menelie's father, having to be deposed. And like, that's what it would take to make that community as it is. And so I appreciate the way that the book, different characters in the book do sort of do that thing. Her brother, who does mm-hmm. love her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's like, let's just let her be. She's, you know, I think she's happier. Right. And everybody's just kind of like, leave it alone. And I love the way that Anne McCaffrey brings the fire lizards into the story, which are, so for listeners who haven't read any of the Pern songs, Pern has all these dragons, which are these magnificent. They're the kind of dragons you'd imagine, but they're telepathic. They bond with a rider who they can sort of speak with. But there's also these creatures that are discovered first in this book, Dragon Song, that are called fire lizards. And fire lizards are like tiny dragons, and they're empathic, but they're not psychic. So they don't talk in words with each other, but they all have these very, I would say, cat-like personality. I think they're like cats with wings.
Very, very smart cats.
Sounds very realistic. Very smart
cats.
Yeah.
and one of the things that's wonderful is that, so when Mentally discovers these eggs that are about to drown because of the waves. And this little queen, it's only the little queen dragons and queen fire lizards are the ones that lay eggs, who's trying to get the eggs to safety, but can't, and Mentally sort of risks her life and sort of tries to get the eggs to safety. And then, the mother fire lizard basically, you know, buggers off and leaves them with Mentally, who has to sort of find ways to feed and deal with all of these little fire lizards. But one of the things I quite loved about it is that Mentally's first sort of shocking thing is how the fire lizards love when she's playing music, right? Mm-hmm. They and it's her first time. And it reminds me so much as a kid of when you feel out of place, but then there's pets or there's like dogs or cats around, where the dogs or cats like don't give a crap how unpopular you are at school. they're just like, you're the coolest, you know, because you're sitting here and petting me. So I adore you. And I just, and so that sort of experience transposed into this world of fire lizards and playing, you know, pipes, like, you know, these sort of interesting pipes that Mentally creates to play songs for them. I just, again, was something that resonated with me. It's, I think Red said something very correct about the sort of the cozy aspect of it. You know, that since Travis Baldry's literature, or sorry, and Lattes, was it?
Yeah, Legends and Lattes. Uh-huh.
Legends and Lattes, yeah. You know, there's... It's often you have this thing that's always around, but someone's book sort of becomes popular and sort of gets pegged with the title, you know, sort of cozy fantasy. There's always been cozy fantasy. It's just, we haven't tended to raise it up that much. Often it's been from female authors. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely true that Dragon Song is very much a cozy fantasy. In that sense, it's personal. It's not always about, you know, killing other people with swords. The stakes are as much about emotions as anything else. But it's a wonderful kind of life to seep into for all. Although I get the feeling that Red doesn't totally agree.
No, it's not that. I'm going to preface this with, I really, really enjoyed this. And I read the first trilogy and I've read Dragonstone. I have some big problems with how the science of this world works, and it makes no sense to me.
Did you not read the prologue, the 30 pages of prologue that constantly tells you all the science?
But yeah, it tells you exactly what happened.
I did a whole episode with Kipton and Ryan from the main thing. Like the thread thing, and like everything would be dead. It would just all be dead. Everything would be dead and things could not evolve. So that's what I'm saying. I have problems with that. I also have problems with problems that are not addressed in this book. But
yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think I know where you're going, and that's doesn't happen in this book. So that's just fine.
Now I want to know what it is.
The mating thing.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a, you know, definitely. You know, if I think Dragon Song is a pretty safe book for people to go read if they want, but if you want to go read Dragon Riders, which I think is the first Dragon Riders of Pern
book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you definitely are going in, need to go in conscious of the fact
there's
that
there's weird sex stuff.
You know, this is it's a book written from another era.
Yeah.
And as much as we anthropomorphize animals, you know, in our kind of imaginations of, you know, my two kitty cats fell in love and it was very lovely, consensual love, you know. it doesn't always quite, when you actually sort of transpose certain types of mating behaviors onto humans, it starts to become
different,
entirely problematic.
Right. Yeah.
It's quite natural to feel a bit weird about that part of it. Thankfully, there's no mating.
I want to say that I really, really enjoyed this book. I enjoy Pern in general.
I was going to say that, just like you said, it's like a small town, this hold that she grew up in. It really is. I mean, he really got that small town feel. And then the new Harper comes in. He's got instructions that are basically like, you need to bring this town up to speed and get them kind of out of their small town mentality. And he's like, I have to go so slow. I have to just take this step by step. And that's the exact same way you have to deal with people in a small town mentality. You just say like, we're going to make one change. It's a small change. It's an easy change. And then you work them up to the next change. And then, you know, by the time you're done, you've changed everything, but it doesn't feel any different because they've worked through it, you know, the right way to say.
And part of the issue with the small town thing is that everybody is just up in each other's business because they're so close together. Whereas when you live in a city, mm-hmm. not that I live in Portland, it's not a terribly big city, but you can get away from the people you don't like and find your own tribe. You don't. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a much less interdependent existence, right? We've kind of designed cities in a way that we're not quite as, we don't need to be quite as interdependent. I've lived, you know, my wife and I have lived in the same house for 21 years, and I think we've had dinner with our front neighbors because we own a duplex. Mm-hmm. And our front neighbors, who we adore, I think we've had dinner with them once, and our neighbors on either side of us, like, never. And you can kind of do that. Whereas, yeah, in those sort of smaller communities, you can't. And the point about the new young Harper being told, you know, bring these people up to speed and how to do that, I think it's a really valid, it's a really interesting area to explore, because this often is the flaw in, like, I'm a pretty left-wing person innately. I mean, I'm Canadian, so by nature I'm left-wing. But there's a tendency amongst, I'm what's called an old school liberal. You know, there's a tendency in sort of progressive circles to sort of view people as kind of backwards and go, we have to educate these people, mm-hmm. you know, and so, you know, we have to tell these people how wrong they are and show them the facts of, you know, historical oppressions and things like that. And forgetting that actually every community has to discover its own progress, and you can help people. You can help people discover their progress. You know, you can help people discover their, but they always have to kind of invent it themselves. And that's the challenge that this book doesn't sort of fully explore, but it, you know, sort of always resonates for me of, you know, telling some guy, all right, you got to go to this town. And, you know, they're all kind of backwards. So you got to like teach them how to not be backwards. And like, that's not really how it works. A little bit like dropping into saying, you know, hey, Joe, I want you to go to Egypt and I want you to teach those people to be way more respectful of women. Like, that's not really like there. You can, there's lots of things you can do, but you have to find ways to enable every culture has to discover for itself how to sort of progress to some degree, which isn't to say you should, you know, have trade deals with nations that are horrible, but that sort of is a very Western conceit, right? The notion of we can just go in and tell people why they're wrong and they'll figure it out. And I think it's one of the reasons why when you see I'm Canadians, the divide's a little less prominent here, but I know in the States, the urban rural divide is just so massive a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And every time I go to the States, every time I meet someone from a smaller town, like, yeah, their feeling is just constantly, why are we just constantly having people tell us that if we were just less stupid, we would agree with them?
Yeah. I really liked how you said it, that they, you have to discover it together with them. You know, you can help them, but everybody or every town is going to have a different experience, and they all might be similar, but they're all different, and you have to help them kind of discover it on their own. Well,
So this is getting a little political for our podcast, but so I want to talk about Lessa, because she is the main character in the first book. Mm-hmm. And I just love her character and her coming into the dinner cave or whatever it is. And she's like, whose dragons are screwing up my life right now? And just that whole, like, she's just such a presence in this book, even though she's not really a main character, but just, she's just got her girl boss on, and it's amazing, and I love her. So anyway, thoughts?
Lessa, so for those who haven't read the other books, and again, you can, one of the beautiful things about Dragon Song is you can just read it on its own. You don't need to have read anything else. You don't need to read anything after it. But in the first Dragon Riders book, Lessa, as Red said, is the main character. And she is, you know, quite brutal from, mm-hmm. from the first moment. Like when, Falar, you know, first comes in, you know, the guy that she's, you know, going to end up, you know, who's looking for recruits to bond with dragons. Her plan is to use him to kill the guy that
killed her family,
sort of oppressing her. And she's very, she is completely unapologetically manipulating the situation to get what she needs. And so, yeah, right from the beginning, she is very much the kind of character who's like, no, I'm taking charge now. And so, yeah, and one of the things I think that Anne McCaffrey does a lot in her Pern books is just bring characters in who have these very strong personalities just to add moments of flavor. And it works wonderfully well here because at that point in the book, of course, you know, mentally, nobody actually knows who she is. She's been rescued because there was, and again, for people who haven't read the books, that one of the driving sort of physical imperatives of this planet Pern is that there is I think it's a dwarf planet or sort of a moon that's in a weird erratic orbit, that produces this kind of spore that manifests as what looks like these long silver threads that basically burn through just about anything, but not like rock and stuff. And so when there's thread fall, if you're out during thread fall, if you get hit by thread, you're going to get burned and you're probably going to die. And so at one point in the book, when Mendeley is kind of rescued from thread fall, people still don't know that she is the girl who's been writing these amazing songs that the Master Harper, Robinson, another one of these very larger than life characters in the series, has been sending out his harpers to look for, the writer of these songs. People don't know who she is, even though she's in one of the dragon holds, or weirs, I think as they're called. And so, yeah, when her fire lizards that only a couple of people have seen before start, just Mendeley's fire lizards are just they are literally a herd of cats, except they're flying and they can teleport. So they just drive her crazy, and she is the most sort of commanding presence in the series. And so she released, and it's perfect because Manly, of course, is still the dominant feeling she experiences throughout the book. And even at that moment is, I don't really belong. I'll get kicked out if I don't want to be kicked out of this place. And so she's absolutely terrified of Lessa, even though the reader, even if you haven't read the other books, has a sense that that's not what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice little piece of suspense. Well,
and I love also
it was
how the Master Harper is like, look, you can't stay here because your dragons are going to drive your fire lizards are going to drive her crazy. She doesn't want to have singing fire lizards in her wear. So you better just come away with me.
Yeah, Lessa. Yeah, McCaffrey doesn't hesitate to give her characters little sort of bigotries, if you will. And yeah, she gives Lessa a kind of an antipathy towards fire lizards that, you know, plays a significant role throughout the series. It sort of says, you can't be trusted. They're little, you know, pains in the butt, and we need to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. We did have Kipton ask. He said to talk about why this is the best entry point to Pern.
I think it's the gentlest entry point into that world. I think it's the one, first of all, I just think it stands on its own as a great book. It's one of those rare books that I can go back and read every few years. And just as a writer myself, I can kind of marvel at the way that McCaffrey so skillfully creates openings for the reader to imagine themselves in that world rather than, you know, there's a tendency now to write books that are more, I would say, sort of hyper directive, right? Like telling the reader everything, like about how everybody looks and what everybody is doing and how everything works. And that can be wonderful in terms of being very vivid and cinematic, but it also kind of keeps the reader out of kind of imagining themselves and imagine and creating the world in their own minds. Whereas there's other books that are too vague, right? They're too generic and they don't quite achieve anything in terms of they're not specific enough for us to feel grounded. And I think Dragonsong does a terrific job of giving you enough detail to make things feel specific, but leaving you space to imagine things yourself. So we don't tend to have a lot of, you know, I would have trouble describing Melanie other than I think she's tall. But you don't feel like, oh, you know, I have to remember exactly what Manly was described as or any of the characters were described as. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very skillfully written in that sense. I think it's a very gentle book. Like I say, if you're trying to pick up, sometimes when I'm, you know, picking a book, you know, because often we read before bed and I'm like, I just want to read something that's not going to boot me out of the story or not going to require that I, you know, bring my dictionary. or just it's not going to, you know, or specifically that's not going to play on my sense of outrage.
Right.
Again, this is a thing and we all do it. And sometimes it's perfectly fine to do it. And I'm sure I've done it in my books, but you know how we all rail against Facebook and Twitter and all these social media platforms that basically the way that they hook us is by playing on our sense of outrage, make us feel disgusted because being disgusted is actually sometimes a tempting feeling, right? We like to feel disgusted.
Right, it's much easier to interact if you're playing on somebody's outrage than on their pleasantness, right? Yeah.
That's why I do my gratitude
and
lists.
So, and so I see a lot of fantasy sometimes that sort of delves into that. Like I'm going to hook the reader by making them feel like by you know, sort of arousing their sense of outrage. And this book really doesn't do that. It is fundamentally sympathetic to all of its characters, even the characters you don't like, even, you know, the characters you're not meant to like. You always have a sense of, I kind of get where they're coming from. Like even Yaris, right? Like the I think it's Yaris or Yanis. Menelie's father.
Yeah, no,
you very much get the sense of someone who's like, this is a tough life. I have to keep all these people fed and alive.
Yep.
And it's dangerous, right? And I don't have time for the community to be kind of torn apart by, you know, silliness or to be confused about everybody's role. I don't want, you know, as I think one of you said before, right? if it was his son, he'd be like, I don't want my son playing tunes. I need him learning to fish and learning to,
right,
you know, handle the economy of a hold. So, yeah, I just love the book.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
My book for,
I think it's a good entry point to Pern for me because it was simple, but it explained, like you said, it explained enough that I get this picture of the world and I understand things that are happening, but I'm not being overwhelmed with the epicness of this story that I'm also having to learn at the same time. It's just, you kind of follow it and you learn stuff and then you can move on to bigger stuff later, different stuff later. So I think it was a really good entry point, actually.
I have only read the first trilogy and Dragon's Dawn, and actually I prefer Dragon's Dawn.
To the trilogy? Yeah.
I just prefer it. It's just me. So.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, Dragon's Dawn, is set quite a ways, yes, before the sort of what we think of as the first trilogy. The other reason, because the question was why read this one first, and I think one reason to read this one first is it'll let you get into the world before you have to contend with some of the more what we would today call problematic aspects. Like it's important to remember that like Anne McCaffrey was an absolutely lovely person. But her attitudes about sexuality and love are not necessarily your attitudes about sexuality and love, right?
That's the one I would prefer. That's the one I would especially recommend to sci-fi readers.
Yeah, Dragon's Dawn is a more sci-fi focused approach. There's nothing about, if you just cut out the prologue, which honestly, I'm not sure I ever read the prologue of Dragonsong when I reread the book, because it's exactly the kind of prologue that they now tell you in writing schools, like not to write. but if you take out that prologue, it is purely a fantasy novel.
Yep.
Right. There's at no point will you think you're in a science fiction novel. Whereas I think Dragon's Dawn is trying to, sort of much more solidly embrace the
to Dragon's Dawn, it really is a backfill that she wrote like years after she started writing those books. And so there's some problems with it because it is a backfill. And I, by the way, speaking of problems, she has some annoying tics in her writing, like saying all of the characters' names way too many times. And this is why I sometimes just want to read a book without wanting to talk about the book, because it would not have bothered me if I didn't have to talk about it. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So anyway.
Yeah. 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 No, she has, look, yeah, she has her own style and her own things to say. And that's the thing, that, when you're reading an author's work, you don't have to accept or embrace all of the attitudes you see espoused by their characters, or even the way that they write. No. I tend to think if you read Dragon Song and you go, oh my God, I love this world, then you'll be better prepared to go into Dragon Riders and those books and then go, ooh, there's some kind of spicy bits to this that I'm not sure how to feel about. And you'd be better able to manage that.
I love that, yeah.
I think if you start with Dragon Riders, there's a chance you'll go, man, this is just from a different era and I don't share these attitudes and this bothers me.
That's something that's very tough to remember sometimes when you're reading, is just, when was this published? Who was it being published towards? Am I kind of the same or how different am I? And make sure to be sure like, yes, this is kind of how it was, or this might be how she thought it was. And that's, that's fair and understandable for her. And it doesn't mean you have to love it, but you can still read it and experience it.
Well, yeah. I think that reading things that are uncomfortable can sometimes be good too. But I will say, much like Sebastian, this is a book that I've fallen asleep to on audio on several occasions because it's inoffensive and it's not inoffensive. That's not the right word. Because it's just safe. It's a safe book. The other one is Lyriel by Garth Nix. But I fall asleep to this book because it's comfortable. So.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes that's just a really nice thing to have, to just a book that you can go back to, and just appreciate in different ways. And you know, like I'm starting to read it in French. I speak French. My French is really bad, but, and when you're trying to relearn how to, you know, sort of read French or just be comfortable with reading in French, it's easier when it's a book, you know. One of the things I'm most grateful for is that my book's been translated into 15 languages. So when I needed to sort of relearn some of my French reading, I was able to pick up a French copy of the podcast or one of my books. It's way easier to translate when you know what the text originally was.
Oh, you froze.
Yeah.
Of course, then you discover liberties that the translators take, and then you're like, God damn it, their idea was way better than mine.
So one of my friends who was learning Spanish, and he was Catholic, he started attending Catholic mass in Spanish because it helped him practice his Spanish because he knew the words already.
That's one way to go about it.
That both Traitor's Blade and Spellslinger are available in Spanish, so your friend should have done that instead.
I think this was before both of those books were published.
I'll give them a pass then. That's good. All right. Here's another question that they wanted to ask you is, what makes dragons so popular in fantasy? And then we already talked about the other parts of his question. So,
yeah, I'm not the best person to answer that because I've never written a book with dragons in it, although I keep threatening to do a book that the working title is called Dragon Ranch. Which I basically, anytime I need to, periodically when you're a novelist or anyone in a creative space, you end up in some kind of weird business meeting where someone randomly says, you know, oh, so what's your next big project? And you're like, oh God, you know, like if I try to describe like Our Lady of Blades, it's going to take half an hour and they're not going to get it. And so I'll periodically just go, oh, it's this thing. It's basically Bridgerton with dragons. And, instantly you're on safe ground. There's like a contract appears before you and someone hands you a pen and says, just do two things, just sign your name and put the amount you want.
That's funny. I like that.
But I think that, you know, I think one of the things about I don't tend to write about dragons. I do tend to write a lot of different animal companions into my books. My latest book, it's funny nowadays I mostly do it because I kind of like it. I kind of find it perversely amusing when like my editor will come back and go, the book is fine. The best character was the mule. or people going, you know, Spellslinger. Yeah. The series is fine. My favorite character is the squirrel cat.
Oh yeah, man. I love the squirrel cat.
The murderous squirrel cat, yes.
but animals do two things. They allow us to, I tend to think like the sort of animal characters allow you to create a kind of mirror on humanity. So it's much easier to have a dragon or a squirrel cat say something that is fundamentally a very basic human thing, but often a very... for want of a better word, sentimental human idea, without the reader feeling like, oh, come on, it's just because the dragon's insecure and just, you know, the dragon's hiding that they're actually crappy. You know, they're motivated by greed just like everybody else. Like it's not, we kind of give them credit. It's sort of a way of externalizing a lot of human values and then reflecting them back at our characters from a voice that we can kind of believe in. And so, you know, if you have, you know, for example, let's just construct a random scenario. So you have, you know, character is, you know, Alex, and Alex is going along and feels horrible and nobody loves Alex. And then, you know, but then there's this talking, you know, dragon who goes, no, you are worthy. You are worthwhile. You are a wonderful person. You know, we'll go, oh, Alex is a wonderful person. Whereas if it's just like somebody's grandma or grandpa who walks along and, no, you're worthy, you're a wonderful person. You're, you know, you go, ah, fuck, what do you know, grandpa?
Yeah.
So it's creating that kind of reflected humanity. I think that's sort of part of it. And just, but also I tend to think, certainly the way that I write those characters, it's that feeling of like that, that bond. We really like that bond. And as much as, the house cats are like the most bizarre creatures on the planet, right? Because they've pretty much evolved to make humans like them.
Yeah.
Like, like meowing is not a thing that cats do in the wild. Like, that was an invention of house cats. And a lot of the frequencies in a cat's meow are the frequencies are parallels to the frequencies of babies in distress. That's why humans sort of react to them so much. But we, so we often think like that house cats have basically evolved to in reflection to humans. But I'm starting to think that humans are starting to evolve to serve house cats. And part of that is just that tendency to just feel that sort of an inexplicable bond that's not probably scientifically valid.
Well, I feel you. My cat is definitely the ruler of this house. Yeah, she knows it, and she gets what she wants when she wants it. She makes sure.
See, and this is why I'm a dog person, even though I have a cat in my house and not a dog. Because dogs actually love you. Whereas cats are like, do I have food?
I always say lately, the two things I've learned about cats is, number one, they are always on vacation. And number two, you are ruining their vacation.
That is really good. That is really good. I have never heard that before, but that fits cats.
Our cats just constantly walk around the house like it's this mildly disappointing resort. The staff is slow. The food is barely tolerable.
Yeah.
The laps are ill-formed and the wrong temperature. But I think we kind of adore that, right? That sense of, I don't know, animals are funny that way. So I think, trying to go back to answer that question, like the fondness of dragons is both that sense of, the power, but also the reflected humanity and the sense of having a bond we often don't feel like we can have with other people, but we feel like we have with dogs and cats and dragons.
Hi. Say hi.
Hi.
Hi, princess. Hi.
Sorry, she's she's bored of watching Frozen, so she's here to join
she's
us.
She's here
so.
To talk about dragons.
I've never seen Frozen.
Oh, it's
yeah. Do you
marginal.
Like dragons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a marginal movie, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, it's fine. It's crack for kids usually for some reason.
Anyway,
so.
So I think we have dragons because there's two things that dragons do. One, they give us a monster that we know we can defeat in a lot of stories, right? I think that's really important. G.K. Chesterton said that we need to know that we can defeat monsters. We don't think monsters are real, but we need to know we can defeat them. There's that one. So you have St. George, whatever. But I also just think that, like Sebastian was saying, is animal companions are fun. We love them. And so we have a cool animal companion that breathes fire. Yay.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's a topic for which I'm alas unqualified to explore, but it is an interesting topic how dragons kind of went from the villain of the piece that we're all rooting to have to see killed, to the sort of honorable, noble companion we all long to have. And how that shift takes place over time. Like, you very rarely see stories now where it's about the evil, crappy dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
and
true. Things have changed a little
really
bit.
It's really funny because Chesky just did a series on dealing with dragons by Patricia Reed on his podcast.
I did. It's a nice. It's a fun series.
What readers are often looking for is find the author whose work they just feel like they can just keep picking up one after another and always enjoy. But it's, yeah, I haven't figured out how to write dragons yet. Brian Naslund, I think I blurred his debut a few years ago, wrote a dragon series that I thought was really interesting because he really, he really went hardcore into the kind of biology of dragons and the different kinds of dragons and all of that stuff. Like, to a, it was a much more kind of faithful or in-depth notion of dragons than the usual, like, well, there's your gold dragons and your red dragons and your green dragons. So he's one to look out for as well, I think, if you're into dragons.
Wasn't there also...
That sounds good. I'll add them to the list, yeah.
But I would like to point out for all these dragon people that I am, I think, acknowledged as the single greatest writer of Squirrel Cats.
100%. 100%.
No one has exceeded my version of a Squirrel Cat yet.
I was going to also say the Natural History of Dragons.
Oh, Marie Brennan, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, she does a great series on world building as well for writers. That's quite interesting. It's too sophisticated for me. I'm just like cool names and move on. But yeah, I think anybody who's looking for a kind of a gentle introduction to the world of Pern, or just a book that's a short, you know, it's a quick, easy, breezy read, Dragon Song by Anne McCaffrey is you're not gonna hate it.
No.
It would take a lot to make somebody hate this book. Yeah,
it's so lovely. It's just lovely.
Yeah, is there, I was trying to see, I've got my original copy of it. Oh yeah, it has a foreword is sort of, the prologue is only about 4 pages long, which you can mostly ignore.
Yeah,
because if you just start it and you open up with, you know, Rubicat in the Sagittarian sector was a, you know, golden G-type star. And it just goes, you get a little confounded.
Yes, that did happen to me 100%. I read it and I was like, I didn't think this was this book, but I'm gonna go with it and just skip past it. But another question really quick from Jeff Dugan. He asked, if you had an unlimited budget to commission any composer to write a song cycle using Menelie's lyrics, which I'm guessing are more throughout the book, and, you know, create more, add or flesh them out more, you know, who would you pick and why?
Neil Finn.
Neil Finn, okay.
Yeah, it's rare that someone throws one of those kind of off-center questions at me where I have an answer. Neil Finn, who was part of Crowded House, just one of the best modern songwriters, and... You know, it would be a little bit torn. There's a Canadian songwriter. Oh my God, I'm going to forget his name. He had a somewhat hit song called Nothing Good. And he's an amazing writer. But it's one of those writers who can write pop music, but whose sort of style contains a little bit of the sort of almost trad music vibe, like almost the key music sort of vibe. I think that's what I would tend to go for. Someone who can write melodies that are not, like, a lot of pop melodies are almost exclusively geared towards being like really stirring, like really just giving the real emotional high. But there's lots of subtleties in melody that can make it really compelling and just pull you along into a story. So I tend to think Neil Finn would be, that's who I'd pick. But I mean, I'd pick Neil Finn for almost anything.
Well, that's fair. If you like him that much, then that must mean he's good.
Listen to Woodface, the fourth Crowded House album. It's one of the best albums of all time.
I'll definitely write that down. That's good. I am very much not musically inclined, so I have no idea who I would commission to write a song. I know lots of people I would not commission to write their songs, but to pick one out of everyone would be too tough for me. So Red, do you have
not
anybody?
Taylor Swift. Sure. Not her. I guess if I had to pick, I'm also not terribly musically inclined. I can play Ode to Joy on the piano. So let's go with.
I can play the Peanuts song on piano.
Oh, see, I can't even do that. Like, I can remember my very basic Ode to Joy that I learned when I was 5.
I've been a musician for like 20 years, and I'm not a piano player by trade. It's mostly guitar and singing, but yeah, I spent forever learning how to play that part because it's so hard.
It is. Yeah. No, so let's say Mozart. He wrote an opera, okay. So let's have him write some songs.
Mozart.
You're going.
Yeah. So Chesky, you in the end did not provide one, did you?
Well, I mean, I just...
Carly Rae Jepsen? It's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I could choose Carly Rae Jepsen. That's I liked the two or three songs of hers I've ever heard, right?
I challenge you to name more than one song.
I don't even know who this person is.
Carly Rae Jepsen, I think she did The Lights and Call Me Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
That's two. I got two songs. That's it.
Call Me Maybe is, I just think, a fabulous song. Like, it's just, like, people criticize it now, but only because it was so just stuck in people's heads so much. Yeah.
That's true. I'll pick Carly Rae Jepsen then. I did enjoy her songs when I listened to them, so I'll go with her. She can adapt these for me.
Carly Rae Jepsen and Mozart. Sitting by the piano
and
the songs for Dragon Song.
And Neil Finn, we'll get him in there. So
let him do the lyrics.
Okay. That sounds great. I think I am.
I think we momentarily forgot who the interviewer was.
I know. Who is it? It's me. That's it. Well, I'm out of good questions. You've answered all the questions that they had. I guess the only other one would maybe be like, how would you sell this in 2024, this book, to somebody? And I think we talked about it already, just that it's a fun, it's cozy, it's easy to get into, but it still tackles really good topics and deals with important things, even in in the way it does, talking about the heartburst and everything and her situation. So I think that was it for me. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a book that, you know, when we try in literature now to talk about topics of importance, we tend to immediately be pulled by the sort of gravitational weight of politics. So it's political topics that when we try to write about things that are important. And Dragon Song for me is always a reminder that you can write about things that are really important to human beings that aren't in and of themselves political in nature, but that are very personal, and that people can all kind of, you know, that almost everyone can relate to. And it's very difficult to write books that kind of everyone can kind of relate to. But I think Dragon Song for me is one of those books. And I hope it is for your listeners.
I think they'll enjoy it as well when they give it a chance. As I know, every listener is going to immediately go out and give it a chance because we've talked about it so praisingly. So.
Unless I completely misunderstood the goal of this podcast and I was supposed to pick something that everybody totally hates.
No, you did good. Red, you're muted. You muted yourself, Red. This was a great book and I'm really glad you picked it. So, Red, did you have something you were trying to say?
Well, I was going to say, no, the point is to share something that you love or influenced you. It doesn't have to be a life-changing book. And I enjoyed it, and I'm glad I got to talk about it, even though I... Sorry, Chesky.
It's okay. My poor sensitive ears will be just fine.
I was more
fine.
Thinking about you,
I'm
having
sure...
to insert the beep. You've heard me swear lots.
No worries.
Oh, really? Does he have to insert a beep every time somebody says, can I just launch it?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll put some beeps in for you.
But also one of the reasons I picked Dragon Song for this is that it's a very short book. I had been contemplating Moonheart, which is another of my favorites by Charles Delay, but Moonheart's quite long, and so I figured that if it turned out that you didn't like it, Red was probably going to be like three times more irritated.
I'm not irritated with you at all.
No, but you could have been.
No.
You would have been if I'd made you read all of Moonheart and you didn't like it.
No. My issue is that it's a book I'd rather just read than have to talk about because I have so many issues with just the world of Pern when I think about it. As long as I'm not thinking about it, I enjoy it greatly. You got to understand, I have read books that I would rate as a 2.5 that I love. I love those books. I don't want to talk about them because they're not great books, but I would put this at like a 3.5. So
there you go.
And there are books that I hate that it's I definitely would
consider. The high three, low fours.
I think I would just say, you know, for, you know, anyone who's got issues with Pern more broadly, you don't encounter those issues in this book. So it's okay. If you just read this book on its own, you'll just have a nice time. You can probably read it on a rainy Sunday.
Yes, for sure.
Cover to cover. And you'll thank us for it.
You will. All right.
And if you don't, you can send complaints, hate mail, and bomb threats to
Chesky.com. That's right. You can, for sure. I can take the hate. I've given and gotten flack for many of my opinions.
Yeah, because you have bad opinions.
Not many of them. A couple of them.
You have bad opinions about some books.
I have great opinions about all the books I read. Sometimes other people's opinions aren't in line with what they should be. But everybody should be in line that Dragon Song is a fun book and an interesting book to read. It's very cozy. It's very nice. And everybody should also be in line that they should read some more Sebastian de Castell books, because they're also all amazing and great. And I have a couple more on my list I still have to go out and get, but then I'm going to read them. So, you know.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, for people who haven't read my stuff and are kind of interested in diving in, the first of my adult fantasy is called Traitor's Blade, and that's a swashbuckling fantasy novel about traveling judges who are forced to duel to enforce their verdicts. And for young adults, you could start with either Spellslinger, which is about a young man in a very magic-driven society who's discovering his own magic is disappearing just weeks before his mage's trials and what he does to try to survive that. Or Way of the Argosy, which is about one of pretty much everyone's favorite character from that series, not the school cat, but Farius. One of the Argosy, and that book's called Way of the Argosy. And then if what you're hearkening for is a... if what you really wanted to read was a swashbuckling Hercule Poirot meets the X-Files, then Crucible of Chaos is out now. It's in the Greatcoats world, but it's a standalone. And Play of Shadows, which is the start of the new Greatcoats series, comes out at the end of at the beginning of April.
Nice. I am so looking forward to those. And just, I don't know if I told you last time, but the Tyrant's Throne, it did make me cry multiple times in the last book.
Me too. Like,
big tears. It was so touching. I did cry. I'm feeling tears even well up just thinking about it again.
And Chesky,
so I'm gonna stop thinking about it.
I want to see the tears. Let's see some evidence.
You want to see some evidence? Well, I don't have the recording of me when I read it, so you'll just have to trust my word for it. But cry I did. Great tears of sadness and joy.
So. I have a question. Are we getting new short stories for the Greatcoats?
Yes. So a couple of years ago, I started publishing short stories for in the world of the Greatcoats, which I was just publishing on my website. And I was selling them for 99 cents, or I think $1.99 if they were novelette length. And I put them together in a collection called Tales of the Greatcoats Volume 1. Now, most people don't read short stories, and most people do not buy collections of short stories. And so I was not expecting anyone to buy this thing. And I have been absolutely shocked by how continuously, like, this has turned out to be a perennial seller for me for reasons I cannot quite fathom.
Because they're good.
It was something I realized I've been sort of preaching this to other writers lately, is that that's the thing you should do, is when you've written a series, because a series is... You know, when you write a series, it's very bound by the main character's arc of that series. But you're always creating a world that's going to have lots of fascinating space for characters to explore. And so with Tales of the Greatcoats, part of what I was doing was just exploring some of those other characters and places and stories that I wanted to do. And I've been honored and just happy with how people have responded to Tales of the Greatcoats Volume 1. I have about half of the stories for Tales of the Greatcoats Volume 2 ready. I already have the cover ready. It's an outstanding cover, so I'm very excited about that. And the other half are the stories are in progress. I just want to make sure that they're as good as they possibly can be. So that will almost certainly be coming out later this year as that second collection. I had sort of meant to do a collection every year, but I kind of ended up in a position where, like, last year I had 3 books published. So, you know, it's I'm in a very particular category of author, which is I make a good living as an author, which is an incredibly lucky and fortunate position to be in. But it's not because it's not because I wrote the Da Vinci Code. Like, it's not that I have one book that, like, just sells millions, you know, or Pat Rothfuss, right, writes The Name of the Wind. And it's just such a beloved book that, you know, you just kind of, I know, you know, it's very challenging for him because he's trying to write his third book and, you know, and the expectations are through the sky. But I'm not in that category. I'm in the category below that, where it's like, your books sell quite well and they sell in multiple languages, but I actually have to write, you know, I have to publish a couple of books a year to sort of do that. So that's why I haven't been able to devote as much time to Tales of the Great Coats Volume 2. But it is underway. It will happen, and it will almost certainly happen before the end of this
year. Well,
that's very exciting.
Yeah, I will be sure that we will be covering it on my other podcast, Wordless, which is dedicated to short stories.
It's a bit of a production putting it together, because, of course, in addition to the ebook and the print design and all that stuff, because that's the only stuff that I self-publish is
very good.
The other stuff's all with trad publishers, but also just wrangling the audiobook version, because, you know, I had 3 different audiobook narrators for different stories where I thought they were suited, and getting Joe Jameson and Kristen Atherton on board takes a little, you know, they're very busy narrators, and they were kind enough to do those ones for me. So, hopefully they still like me enough to do Tales of the Great Coats Volume 2. So yeah, soon.
I'm sure. All right. Well, that is exciting. And with that spectacular piece of news coming out, we're going to conclude our episode. If you want to chat with us about anything we covered or missed in this episode, or you have some other strong opinions about Dragon Song or any of Sebastian's books, you know, come check us out on the Legendarium's Discord. There's a link on the online. You can also follow us on Twitter and other social medias for more updates. But thank you again so much, Sebastian De Castello. It's such an honor and a pleasure to be talking with you all this long.
Yes.
So. Oh, thanks so much. I'm happy to come by anytime.
Okay. We'll be happy to have you back on.
Yeah. And thanks, Little Red.
Thank you
for being here. I'm Chesky. We'll see you guys next time. But it was great talking with everybody and listening. I hope you had a fun time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast.